Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today I'll be taking time to speak with Vice President of Academic Affairs and Professor at New England College, Wayne Lesperance, and Professor of Economics and Business at St. Anselm College, Stefan Unger. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. President Trump wants to help fund a border wall by using a pool of money from an asset forfeiture fund that the Treasury Department has tried to protect. Last year, the Treasury warned against raiding the fund because it is used to aid in criminal investigations and court proceedings. But the raiding of that fund has been happening for years, to the tune of $12.3 billion over the last decade. President Trump is hoping to divert $601 million from it to put toward the $6.7 billion he wants for a wall. The president's claim on the fund is being challenged in court. The return of earmarks and appropriations bills may not be right around the corner. The Republican-controlled Senate has no plans to resume the practice that has been banned since 2011, and the Democratically-controlled House has made the same decision, at least for the 2020 process. Bipartisan agreement on the return of earmarks has apparently been lacking. Some lawmakers oppose them because they can encourage corruption, while others support them because they can also encourage compromise. Republican leadership in the Senate must determine what to do with a House-passed resolution that directly challenges President Trump's authority to redirect money for a border wall, especially as some Republican senators have also voiced concern over the president's move. There is also talk of trying to amend the resolution, which must by law receive a vote on the Senate floor. If it passes and goes to the president's desk, it would likely trigger President Trump's first ever veto. Up next, I'll be joined by Vice President of Academic Affairs and Professor at New England College, Wayne Lesperance, to discuss student engagement, issues that matter to them, and the New Hampshire primary. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Wayne Lesperance. Wayne is the VP of Academic Affairs at New England College. He's won awards for his work there, such as Teacher of the Year and Advisor of the Year. He has a law degree from Northeastern and a master's from Old Dominion. He can be heard on local and national news programs. In fact, he's frequently on Pints and Politics on WKXL. Wayne also takes a keen interest in the New Hampshire primary, putting together the New Hampshire Primary Student Convention every 4 years that gathers hundreds of students and garners lots of attention from presidential candidates. Welcome to Facing the Future, Wayne.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Chase.
Well, it's a pleasure having someone as prestigious as yourself on the show to talk a lot about student engagement and issues they care about, as well as I'd like to dabble in your experience in the New Hampshire primary. So let's jump right in. How you work with students quite a bit in your day job. You corral them all every 4 years when you do the convention. How politically and civically engaged is this generation of students?
Well, I would say that they are at least as engaged as every student I've had. Over the years, I've been teaching for 20 years now. I think what's different is the range of interests they have. You know, there were the issues that you could count on, you know, young people caring about in the old days, and I think now because of access to media and information that is unprecedented, there's a lot of informed opinion and thinking, but about a whole host of issues. So. That's pretty exciting to me because it keeps me on my toes with them in a classroom. I can't assume anything. And, you know, we have the added advantage since we are first in the nation of attracting students to New Hampshire that really want to be involved in the political process. So it's kind of a embarrassment of riches for me these days.
Actually, that brings up a great point. I was going to ask, do you think that level of engagement is a bit unique to New Hampshire and being a New Hampshire-based college because of the primary.
Oh, it really is. I mean, and it's intentional. We recruit, you know, students to become poli-sci majors or kids that are interested in social justice issues or, you know, anything that's being debated in Washington or in capitals across the country. You know, we go after those students and say, this is an opportunity to play on the big stage. You're going to see the next president of the United States come through our campus and have an opportunity to ask them questions. Very few states can make that claim.
I guess my question, you mentioned social media plays a factor, the draw of the state can be a bit of a factor, but from your perspective and your opinion, what is really driving them to step up and have their voices be heard even during campaign season as opposed to just in the voting booth?
Sure. I guess I'd say they feel that their voices aren't heard. You know, when you look at the voter turnout, typically we're looking at a demographic much older than the average college student that turns out. And, you know, talking to students, especially those that are actively engaged, they'll say, you know, I'm kind of tired of my grandparents making the decisions that are going to affect my life. We have different goals, different outlooks. I'd like to at least have my voice in the process. And so getting involved, you know, showing that they have a stake in what happens is increasingly important to them. The other thing I'd say is they, like all the rest of us, look and see what's going on in D.C., and many of them have concluded that our system is broken. And the only way to fix it is to make sure you get involved. So there's lots of different motivations, but I'd say those are the two bigger ones.
And Wayne, since they're a little more self-engaged in this process, are they pretty autonomous in, you know, what opportunities they pursue, what campaigns they get involved with, or do you, as their advisor and professor, or even the school, sort of help guide them along and direct them into opportunities?
So I would say that what we do is we present them with the opportunities as they come to us. And, you know, if you've been here a while, you get to know the folks who are the players out there, people like you, Chase, and, you know, you guys come along and you say, hey, we're working on this, and, you know, do you have any students that might be interested? And what I typically do then is I try to think of the students who I think might be ready to take advantage of an opportunity like that, and then I give them options. I really don't think what we want are faculty members guiding students to particular points of view or types of issue organizations. We want to present the full array of choices and, you know, help them make informed decisions about that, and that's kind of the work that we do.
And Wayne, you also just mentioned a pretty key word, and that was ready. You try to identify the students that are ready to step up and get engaged. Do they pretty generally come into the classroom with you or with other professors with a pretty deep knowledge of how our government works and civics in general, or in many ways do you have to sort of teach that as you go along?
No, it's probably one of the more frustrating parts of where we are, and it's not their fault, but civics education, civic literacy in our country is really, I would argue, at an all-time low. But I would say that we have generations of folks in the United States that are civically illiterate, and that's a pretty heavy charge, but I stand by it. We're not devoting enough time in our K-12 education to this. We're not spending enough time with our students, you know, as young students, as high school and middle school students, and really having a sense of understanding of how it all works. So they'll come in with, you know, a basic knowledge, and we build that, and we build on that. And we use their curiosity and what they care about, the issues they care about, as a vehicle to engage them. But real, just basic, fundamental knowledge of our founding, of the founder's promise, what it means to be America, those things are largely lost these days, and we have to find a way to get them back in the classroom. So we spend a lot of time with that.
So setting aside the issues pertaining to civics education within our system at the moment, we talked about students come in pretty charged up about issues, and that range of issues has changed over the years. What are maybe the top three or four issues you're hearing about right now that students really get excited to discuss?
I'd say climate change is very much at the top of the list for many of the students. I think they very much see the concerns that are being expressed by the experts out there, and you know, that's real for them. It's their future. I think human rights, equal rights, the full panoply of true equality, of shared equality for all citizens is very important to them. So when they see things, you know, discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender or race, that's very, very strange for them. That's not their experience. They've grown up at a time when America has made promises about equality, and so they're very keen on pushing back against that. And I think, finally, there's a shared concern about our system, that, you know, it's not working. It's not working for them, that what happens in Washington, what passes for governing, isn't really much by way of governing. It's It's much more just a lot of arguing and a lot of intransigence. So I think they're concerned that what we've promised as the greatest system of government in the world is not working all that well, and they'd like to see something done about that.
And Wayne, you mentioned you've been teaching for about 20 years now, so I'm sure you've seen a wide variety of students coming through the doors. And I imagine that, you know, after you have a student for a semester or for a couple of years, you hear feedback or have exit interviews with them about different types of engagement or internships. Are there any themes that you've heard over the years that these students might share with you about something they've learned or some experience that they were particularly excited about as they go through that education and engaging in things like the New Hampshire primary?
Yeah, I think it's those one-on-ones. I'd like to believe it's my awesome lecture on the Electoral College, but the memories they typically have are about an experience or an event or, you know, conversation with a really influential person. And what's great is we get them all that together. You mentioned we do this convention every 4 years, and we do, and we bring students from all over the country together. But I also invite all my alums, and we have kind of a mini reunion in the middle of it, and listen to them talk about their experiences when they were students. It's remarkably similar in the sense that they've met somebody along the way that has had a tremendous impact on their thinking or on their life. So I guess because we're first in the nation, those opportunities abound, and I love that we can create that chance for those students.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Professor Wayne Lesperance about student engagement and issues that matter most to them. And we just started transitioning a bit, Wayne, talking about the New Hampshire primary, the student convention. I was curious, can you share with me, with our listeners, what your first experience was in the New Hampshire primary and what that was like?
Sure. I had just moved up here. It was 1999. I remember this clearly. I was in, I want to say I was in Target. Maybe it was Walmart. But I was in Concord, and I was doing some shopping. I just moved up here, and I was trying to pick up some furniture and things like that for my new apartment. And I saw a crowd gather, and I sort of went over to see what was going on. And out of the crowd came George W. Bush. He was just sort of doing a walkthrough and work event, talking to people, and I thought, my goodness, I'm from Virginia. I'd never seen anything like this in Virginia, where you have access to candidates the way they do up here, and it really, for me, made a big impact in the sense that I really chose the right place to come do my work. If you're going to teach poli sci, there's really no better place to be than in New Hampshire. So that was kind of one of my first memories.
Yeah, I think I'd agree. I moved up here for law school and got engaged right away and love that you have sort of that one-on-one experience. You can literally have a presidential candidate in your living room and have coffee with them by the fire to talk about the issues. And at what point, so you've been teaching for 20 years, at what point did you start the student convention and what inspired it at that time?
So same sort of thing. You know, NEC was a partner with some other folks who had put on the first college convention in 1999, or January 2000. So at that point, you know, we came as just partners in that endeavor. And, you know, I kind of watched it. I remember calling my friends from grad school and folks I've known for years and saying, you're not going to believe it. You know, they're all here, and they all come through this event. And you know, my friend said, well, how do we work it out so that we can bring students? Because they were all teaching at different colleges and universities all over the country. And so I just sort of built from there and said, look, what if we were to do this thing and really focus on high school and college students and bringing them to New Hampshire and giving them 3.5 days or 4 days of that first in the nation experience? And what I found is we had no trouble finding folks that wanted to come do that. Our goal was never to make any money at it. So, you know, we're a nonprofit. We just want to cover our expenses. We're able to do that. We bring just about 1,000 students from all over the country, with the largest group coming from Louisiana, of all places. And it's all to have a taste of the thing that we all sort of take for granted, and that's the first in the nation primary.
So we're fast approaching the 2020 primary, and I'm curious, you've already been talking to some of the candidates. I'm sure you're gearing up for the next convention. How have things changed, even from the 2016 cycle? Obviously, we have a stronger Democratic primary than Republican primary this time around. So aside from that, how has the climate changed? How have the topics changed? How have the candidates changed moving into 2020?
I think the big story for 2020 is the mainstreaming of progressivism in Democratic Party. If you think about Bernie Sanders last cycle, he was kind of a bit of an odd duck in lots of ways, but his progressive position on politics was very different than what you saw from somebody like Hillary Clinton. So you look at this cycle now, and there are so many choices that would like to and can check off that progressive box next to their name that it really says a lot about how the Democratic Party has moved to really embrace a more progressive perspective. I think, too, that, you know, whether or not we have a number of these folks do it or not, that a sitting United States president is being challenged for his party's nomination says something about where we are on the Republican side and where the president, frankly, is with the country in terms of his popularity and the various issues that are have come up to challenge the legitimacy of his presidency. So, you know, there's a lot of context, there's a lot of fluidity right now in the process, but, you know, voters are going to have a tremendous amount of choice in terms of just sheer numbers. And even with range, I mean, if you think about the breadth of kinds of candidates on the Democratic side, there's quite a few different points of view being represented there, and that's kind of exciting.
And Wayne, I know you've been around the block a few times when it comes to the primary and the campaign process, and obviously narrative is very important on the campaign trail for candidates, and sometimes that narrative can be beyond their control. Sometimes they can dictate what's being said about them or what issues they're discussing. But right now, as you attend events or host events at NEC, are you seeing narratives around certain candidates or issues being driven by the attendees of events, the questions they ask, or is it largely still in that stump speech mode and candidates are pushing the issues out there?
So I think we're still in the bio phase, which is where candidates try to introduce themselves to the audience. What's fun is that we all recognize the activists from the different organizations. So I attend events and there's almost always an AARP representative there talking about, you know, the issues that matter to them. And I swear by the end of the cycle, they're going to have gotten every candidate to answer that one question that they want to get answered. But that's awesome, and that's part of the deal here. In terms of just general audience members, I wouldn't say there's any one particular issue other than commentary on what's going on in Washington now and, you know, people's perspectives on the president and how he's doing. I think that's what the driving force right now. But other than that, candidates are trying to build a narrative around their biography as a way of introducing themselves to the public.
And putting your professor hat on here, this will be the last question, Wayne, putting your professor hat on and looking at it from how you guide and instruct your students, how would you hope that presidential candidates today would engage your students? I'm trying to get beyond social media and you're hoping maybe for that personal contact. How do you think candidates should be engaging students today?
Well, first thing is what not to do, and that is don't be patronizing. The candidates that try to be cool or fit in, it just always comes off clumsily. It's awkward. It just isn't right. Treat them like you would any voter. You know, talk about the issues. Talk about the issues that matter. Talk about the issues that matter to them. I would say that don't patronize. Don't pander. I think if you're gonna disagree with them on an issue, then disagree with them. They're old enough. They're mature enough to handle it. And I think they respect that the integrity of somebody saying, well, you know, I appreciate your point of view, but I don't agree. I was a big fan of John McCain's straight talk approach, and I really think we need a lot more of that these days.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and Professor Wayne Lesperance discuss student engagement, issues that matter most to them, as well as the New Hampshire primary. Thanks for joining the show, Wayne.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Chase. Have a great day.
You too. Up next, Professor Stephen Unger will join me to discuss his involvement with a recent World Energy Council summit and his use of the Concord Coalition budget exercise in his classroom. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Stephan Unger. Stephan is an assistant professor in the Department of Economics and Business at St. Anselm College. He has a doctorate from the Vienna University of Economics and Business. He has worked for a brokerage firm and a bank. He's also CEO of an algorithmic FX trading company, is an active member of the World Energy Council as senior advisor for WEC Austria. And a fun fact, Stephan is also a jazz pianist. Welcome to Facing the Future, Stephan.
Hello, Chase. Thanks for the invitation.
Well, thank you. You're calling from all the way out in Austria, into the show, so a big thank you to you for taking the time. I wanted to have you on because I wanted to discuss your involvement with the Concord Coalition. You've also welcomed us into your classroom to facilitate our budget exercise. Also wanted to touch on your work with the World Energy Council and a summit you did in the fall. So before we dive into all that, I was curious, how did you first hear about the Concord Coalition? And I know you've attended several of our events. What do you think of what we do?
So the first time I heard about your organization was actually at a conference or the meeting you had actually at our college, St. Anselm College. And this was, you addressed really important topic, namely the issue about raising federal debt. And since we all know that current debt levels are unsustainable on the long term, you do a really brilliant job, in my opinion, by addressing this issue and bringing it out to the public. So in my opinion, you do a really fruitful job.
Well, I appreciate the praise, probably heaping it on too much for us, but you also brought us into your classroom. You had us facilitate one of our budget exercises called Principles and Priorities with a group of your students. What prompted you to want to do that? Why did you think it was important to have this budget exercise facilitated with your students?
So actually, this course I was teaching was International Financial Management. So it covers basically the basic concepts of government funding and financing of governments and principal economics. You know, what is GDP, how is it comprised and calculated, up to how foreign exchange markets work. And since I know that the issues you are addressing are really crucial for this topic, I simply wanted to get the students some hands-on work by setting up an own budget. And I mean, the topics you covered in this exercise, it's really from reality. Yeah. So, like, you cover general government spending, for example, or they have to decide on how much money they would spend on national security or defense spending, or some examples on healthcare, social security, how much taxes should be raised or lowered. And in the end, at the exercise, they have to see if the budget is balanced or not, so if it's a surplus or a minus. And this was very well received by the students, so they love to do this to see how the negotiating process actually really works, and that it's not easy to come up and with solutions and find a one straight answer. It's always a negotiating between all parties. And that was a really good experience for the students.
Yeah, I think that's one of the aspects of the exercise I like the most, is that it puts participants in the driver's seat. They get to experience what it's like to make some of those compromises and make some of those tough decisions, and they've got to learn how to work together, which I think might be missing a little bit when it comes to our national policy leaders and elected officials and how they interact with each other. You mentioned that it was a pretty well-received exercise. Did you get any specific feedback from students?
Yeah, what I heard that they are jealous for the next classes we will take you to this exercise, so we'll definitely invite you for other classes too, and make it a definite ingredient of this course, because that addresses exactly what they have to learn about, that it's not easy just to have one opinion on one topic, but to see the broad range of what implications one policy might have on the budget in a different field. And in my opinion, essential for not only economics and finance students, but it should be necessary knowledge for everybody who wants to take and participate in the political discussion next course in daily life.
Stefan, that actually brings up a question I had, and that is, when you look at the process, the budget process in the United States and how we handle things, what are the major differences between how Austria handles its fiscal policy and finances compared to the U.S.? Is Austria similar to other European countries? How do they compare at all?
So basically, as you know, Austria is part of the European Union. If you compare now the European Union and the United States, there's, of course, a huge difference, because simply the European Union is not a fiscal union like the U.S. is. So every member state, like Austria, does their own budget. A main difference would be we have many more political parties. It's not like just split up between Democrats, Republicans, also to mention the Libertarians maybe. But we have a spectrum of political parties. Like, it differs from every election to every election, but like 7-8 parties. So that makes, on the one hand, negotiation processes easier, but in the end, to find a majority, it makes it easier, but the process itself might be as stuck as in the U.S., what I've experienced so far. So that's major difference between the member states of the European Union, I would say, and the U.S. Another one is simply the system, the structure. We have, for example, higher, not only higher taxes, but social security. Social security is what we have to pay in every month for having, you know, a security net, so to say. So in case there is a downturn in the economy, it's supposed to be a net, a buffer for society, which might be a little bit, how should I say, more flexible than the in the U.S. In the U.S. it seems to me a little bit more brutal, because you're more, of course, independent on the one hand. On the other hand, you're missing the social security net. On the other hand, that means, of course, a higher burden of your income, your net income. So it has all advantages and disadvantages. So this, I would say, are the main differences between the systems, what I see.
And Stefan, you mentioned that the political party structure is different, but you have some similar programs built into the financial system of Austria. In the U.S., a lot of our systems are on, as you mentioned, an unsustainable path. They're contributing to a quick and large growth in our national debt. Does Austria have similar issues? Are they experiencing a similar level of fiscal, you know, unsustainability in some of their key programs, or have they found a way to adequately pay for them and thus don't need as much debt?
So basically, it's the same mess as in the U.S. So, we have the same problems. Debt's a never-ending story. We are not as in debt as the U.S. In Austria, it's roughly around 80% of the GDP, while in the U.S. it's more than 100%. But nevertheless, it's a huge issue here, too. The only difference what could be seen in the last years was actually due to monetary policy, because of negative interest rates we had on government bonds in the northern European countries like Austria and Germany. That was that the negative interest rate actually yielded to a decline in the debt levels. So the last years, we could see a decline in these levels, while, of course, in the U.S., positive interest rates, we could see that debt levels were increasing in addition to the fiscal policies, which added additional debt. So that's what we could experience here.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Professor Stefan Unger. We're discussing, well, we'll get to his involvement with the World Energy Council and a summit they put on. We've also been talking about his work with the Concord Coalition, inviting us into his classroom to facilitate our budget exercise. And we were also just dabbling a bit in Austrian government and fiscal policy compared to the U.S. And a couple questions that I had, Stefan, following up on that. So in the U.S., we have, you know, a debt limit. We have an appropriations process. We're not required to balance our budget. It doesn't sound like Austria is required to balance its budget either. Does it have anything, any mechanism like a debt limit, or does it just acquire the debt it needs without any hindrance?
Yes, second point. Yeah, exactly. We don't have any debt ceiling or anything. We have something that's called like a fiscal council. That's like what the central bank is for the monetary policy. The fiscal council gives advice on fiscal issues, on policies, and they try, of course, not to exceed a certain limit. Like it's from the European Union said that every member country shouldn't exceed a certain limit, I think 2% or something, every year to have a deficit. The point is, if a certain member country violates this barrier, nothing happens. There's no punishment for it. So of course, what happens? Everybody breaks it, or I think there were just one or two countries who stuck to that. So, yeah, we could see that if you have trust on the member countries that they might not violate it, I wouldn't go that path.
So it sounds like the fiscal council in for Austria or even the EU is about as effective as our debt limit, not really constraining that growth at all.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
And you mentioned using negative interest rates as a form of monetary policy. What's economic growth like right now in Austria and in neighboring countries? Have negative interest rates had any impact on that?
Over the long period, so the last years, I would say debt levels have declined on the one hand. On the other hand, what we can see, especially within the last month, is that economic slowdown. So this is maybe due to concerns about trade policies and the trade deal, especially between U.S. and China. This affects, of course, Europe too. That's exporters and the business confidence in general is not so positive anymore, and we could see a decline in on GDP and also in the forecast. So it seems like there's this one word that was called decoupling from the U.S. Of the U.S. from the rest of the world economy. As you could see, especially in the stock market, U.S. was increasing over the last months and last 1-2 years, especially, I mean, got more volatile, but it's still very robust on uprise, while the rest of the world, and especially Europe, it seems like they are in the beginning of a recession. So negative interest rates, it seems like it helps the northern countries, like Germany and Norway, Sweden, Austria, and these countries, to reduce some debt level, to get pressure off on that side. But it doesn't really seem to stimulate the economy on the long term.
So with the rising debt in Austria, Stefan, and the seeming slower growth or stagnation of the economy for the country, how has the public responded to this? Have they noticed? Do they care?
Of course. I mean, that's where we come a little bit into the mentality of each culture. Austrians tend to be very relaxed and not to complain much, as you have seen maybe in, or heard in France, the Yellow Vest movement, large protests every weekend against President Macron. So there, people are already revolting and going on the street. Germany is also not very stable currently at the moment, so it seems like, especially with respect to the upcoming Brexit, nobody knows what's going to happen. It's just a big game, or there will be a deal or no deal, or it will be postponed. Nobody knows, but it adds uncertainty in the market, and as we know, markets hate uncertainty.
And I want to transition to talking about your efforts with the World Energy Council and the summit you've had. But before we do, one last question I had, sort of keeping in with that global mindset we've sort of focused on here. When you mentioned Brexit and you mentioned the changing economy and markets and different nations in Europe, how do you think those might impact the U.S., or how do you think the U.S. might impact those European countries?
Ah, that's a good question. In my opinion, Britain and the U.S., they are already on an ongoing marriage. So my opinion is the European Union wants to hold Britain, of course, in the European Union. I mean, they are the third biggest economy, and they are actually paying more in than they get. So if that breaks away, this messes up the whole European budget. On the other hand, the Britons know that if they can negotiate a good trade deal with the U.S., they might be better off. So in general, of course, the U.S. is still interested in having good negotiations and deals, or trade deals with Europe in general. But it seems like, especially with the current Trump administration, it's not in their first, their main goal, their interest. They are more focusing on the U.S., what's happening domestically, than what's going on in Europe, actually. So that's also the reason why European Union, they feel a little bit like, not frightened, but they are discussing now about setting up an own army, a European army, which doesn't exist yet. So it's on an initiative of France and Germany. So there's a lot of things going on currently. So we will see how this will play out.
All right. So, Stefan, what is the World Energy Council, and what's your role in it? And then maybe kick off the conversation, this part of the conversation, on describing what the summit was that you held in the fall of 2018.
Yes. So the World Energy Council, basically that's a worldwide non-governmental organization, also non-profit. The main goal is basically the promotion of affordable and sustainable energy, so for all. So it's a platform, a networking platform for professionals and academics, where everybody who participates there contributes with scientific ideas, political ideas, how to really translate knowledge into sustainable and affordable energy on the whole world. So I'm basically in the World Energy Council in Austria on the board, as well as on the program committee in London. And so they have really nice topics there. They are ranging from government institution relations, partners, and business development. It's everything that's energy related, I would say. So this is a very good platform for promotion of also young energy professionals, of future energy leaders. Working on several areas there.
And you had this summit in Vienna in the fall. And what did you try to cover in terms of topics in this summit? And how might what was discussed there affect or implicate the United States?
So this summit, I actually was the organizer of this summit. It was about the petrodollar and the current status and future outlook. And so we addressed several very important topics which are currently evolving around the world and which have huge implications for the U.S., for the fiscal policy, as well as global macroeconomic policies. So on the one hand, we address questions like what does Saudi Arabia's move towards renewable energy mean for the petrodollar, or what are the implications of the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative on Western economies, so that affects Europe too, as well as so the danger of if the petro-yuan might replace the U.S. dollar, the petro-dollar. So, we invited some international experts and simply discussed these things, what their opinion is, if there are, what are the threats, what can be done, what can be expected, and so we even recorded it on TV and had some really nice feedback for this event. Yeah.
Okay, so Stefan, our last question here before we have to let you go. When we're talking about what the Concord Coalition does, we talked earlier about U.S. fiscal policy trends there. We touched on what's happening in Austria and other European countries. We touched on what's going on with the World Energy Council and how it might implicate the U.S. Taking all of that into consideration, if you were sitting in the room with a presidential candidate here in the United States, because in New Hampshire we get to see a lot of them leading up to the primary election, if you were sitting in the room with a candidate, what would you ask them or what would you tell them in terms of advice concerning all of these issues?
I have one, just really one, and that's the most important question which I would have, and that should really be addressed to everybody who is interested in running a country like the U.S. Is how are they securing that the demand for U.S. dollars will sustain? Because that's where all our wealth depends on. It's a really huge threat with this emergence of the launch of the Chinese yuan traded future in oil, pick up on volume. As many contracts were traded since January now have the same volume as the WTI oil. That means everybody's trading as much, or the demand for Chinese-traded yuan futures is as high as for U.S. dollar futures in oil. And that, of course, has huge implications, because as long as there is demand there for U.S. dollars, it's easy for the U.S. government to finance the country and issue treasury bonds. As seems like if that gets threatened, they might face really problems, and that meaning we might face inflation in the future. So that would be my most important question.
That's a great point, asking how long they think demand for the dollar will exist at the level it does that helps us finance all of our spending. I'd probably ask a very similar question. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and Professor Stefan Unger discuss his involvement in the World Energy Council, his work with the Concord Coalition, having us in his classroom with his students, as well as what's going on in his neck of the woods in terms of fiscal policy. Thank you for joining the show, Stefan.
Thanks a lot, Chase.
We'll be back after these short messages for our final segment, Facing the Facts. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and this is our final segment, Facing the Facts, where I share with you a fact or a piece of information that I think is worth you pondering until next week's show. So, it's time to face this fact. Even the Federal Reserve Chairman is challenging apathy about the debt, so why are policymakers sitting on their hands? With many lawmakers in both parties acting as if the high and rising national debt doesn't matter, Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell has provided a timely reminder that it does. Powell delivered that message to Senate and House committees last week. In prepared testimony, he acknowledged Fed officials generally view current economic conditions as healthy and the economic outlook as favorable. But he also said that the nation faces important longer-run challenges that include high levels of federal borrowing. Powell said it is widely agreed that federal government debt is on an unsustainable path. And he had a blunt response when asked about modern monetary theory, which downplays the significance of U.S. government deficits and has been cited by some Democrats to support plans for higher spending. He said, "The idea that deficits don't matter for countries that can borrow in their own currency, I think, is just wrong." He noted that the national debt is already high relative to the size of the U.S. economy and is growing significantly faster than GDP. As in the past, Powell emphasized high spending on healthcare as a key factor in the nation's unsustainable fiscal path and identified low productivity growth as another long-term challenge the country is facing. And he expressed concern about relatively stagnant incomes for many families and the lack of upward economic mobility among people with lower incomes. But Powell concluded that we as a nation are going to have to spend less or raise more revenue. His remarks reflect mainstream economic thought and echo the conclusions of many other respected analysts, both inside and outside the government. Previous Fed chairs have also voiced concerns to Congress about the rising debt. Unfortunately, many elected officials in both parties seem to have trouble getting the message. Republicans approved large deficit finance tax cuts a little more than a year ago, and many of them are talking about more such cuts in the future, and they're looking to add more defense spending. Democrats have some ambitious spending plans of their own, but it's not clear how these might be responsibly financed. Meanwhile, total federal debt recently passed $22 trillion, and the Congressional Budget Office, or CBO, projects that under current laws, annual deficits will add $11.6 trillion to the debt over the next decade. CBO projections also show the debt held by the public rising from 78% of GDP to 93% over the next decade alone, and that's based on the shaky assumption that Congress and President Trump won't pass spending plans and tax cuts that will require more federal borrowing. To put our debt path in context, debt held by the public peaked in 1946 at 106% of GDP as a result of the massive borrowing needed to finance World War II, and we're reaching those levels without that kind of crisis at hand. Our longer-term economic and fiscal challenges are neglected when Congress and the White House spend excessive amounts of time, as they have in recent months, arguing over annual funding decisions that involve only a slice of the federal budget. Elected officials in both parties would do well to heed Chairman Powell's words and focus more on holding down the debt while finding ways to promote long-term economic growth by boosting productivity, reining in healthcare costs, enlarging the labor force, and even ensuring that hard work is adequately rewarded. You have been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.